නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස dear Dhamma friends, so we were discussing Pottapada Sutta, and it's a long discourse. Therefore, it is included in the Digha Nikaya, long discourses of the Buddha. And so if I summarize the discussion so far, what we have done, so basically Pottapada is one of the wandering ascetic. He had many followers, and they were discussing some different matters at a particular place, and Buddha approached there, and then the Pottapada raised a question asking how the cessation of perception is brought in successive steps, how one may gradually cease the perception. So basically, when that is mentioned, so Buddha gave a comprehensive answer. So the essence of the sutta is mainly that, and that is what I have summarized here in this chart, in this diagram. So basically, Buddha gave a threefold answer in that sense. So basically, when Pottapada asks how this gradual cessation of perception happens, so one can interpret it as how gradual conceptual proliferation also happens. Because as you know, perception, signs are the root cause for mental proliferation. So therefore, if one is able to gradually calm down, gradually eliminate different kinds of perceptions, that of automatically will eliminate the various kinds of proliferations one may have. And on the other hand, when perceptions calm down, perceptions completely cease, that also has a effect on the consciousness. The consciousness also has to go to a kind of a non-proliferative state or non-established state, because otherwise this can't be successful. So there are interlinks between this question, even though the question is related to the cessation of perceptions. Now, when Buddha starts giving the answer without immediately starting the solution, he first of all put aside one wrong idea, that is, one person has put forward. He has mentioned that these perceptions happen due to no reason, and therefore it is completely out of control. So therefore it is not a kind of a cause and effect relationship. But altogether Buddha denied that, and Buddha mentioned perceptions do occur due to causes and conditions. And again Buddha mentioned, as a kind of a rule of thumb, that some perceptions arise through training and some perceptions pass away through training. So training is the significant fact here. So then Buddha starts to elaborate what kind of training that one has to undergo in order to calm down harmful perceptions and in order to arouse beneficial subtle perceptions. Now he starts first of all with morality, and given a complete account of morality, because Pottapada and the group are an ascetic group, and they are into renunciation, and therefore Buddha oriented this sermon more into the renunciation, and therefore a comprehensive account of sila, morality, is included in the sutta. And after mentioned that, sense restraint also mentioned as indriya sangvara, because now one is going through kind of an operation where one has to continue one's practice carefully. So if one has real determination to calm down mental proliferation, calm down various forms of perceptions, then one has to avoid the incoming events, incoming beneficial or harmful perceptions into the mind. So through the senses, they are continuously coming in, and one has to have some restraint in order to minimize that. And then on the other hand, mindfulness and clear comprehension has to be developed, so that one is aware of what is going on, and it is not limited to a sitting posture, walking posture. Rather, it is a ongoing process distributed throughout the whole bodily behavior, verbal behavior, and mental activities. So therefore, mindfulness and clear comprehension is another aspect of the practice. And having all these things, one may be content and not that going after this and that. Rather, what if one has something, if it is dependable, if that is enough, so then one can maintain that kind of a contentment without going after various luxurious items. Therefore, when this is oriented towards monks, so the four requisites are the primary needs of the monk, and so regarding those four requisites, a monk is quite satisfied, has to be satisfied. If he is going after most valuable items, so that is not the type, that is not the proper monkhood that the Buddha is proclaiming here. So he mentioned that whatever the pindapatha, whatever the alms that you get, whatever the robes you get, whatever the dwelling place you have, and whatever the medicine you have, so just try to be satisfied with bare minimum. So that is the advice in the contentment. And you are quite happy, not that you think about the best and have some sort of an unsatisfaction, kind of a frustration, but contented with what you already have. After mentioning all these things, so Buddha now get on to the mental development part, the Samadhi Sikha, and that is where gradually the concentration is developed. So first of all, the five hindrances are subsided, and then as a result of that, gladness arises in the mind, and then when the gladness is available, fair amount of happiness and pleasure, piti, rapture going to arise in the mind. As a result of that, the body becomes calm, tranquil, mind also becomes tranquil. And when the body and the mind are tranquil, one may experience happiness, one may experience comfort, feeling at ease. As a result of that, automatically mind get concentrated. So the concentration is such that kind of a gradual development, and it happens as a kind of cause and effect relationship. And therefore, concentration is now fairly available. And now, Buddha directly touched the question raised by Pottapada. That is how certain gross kind of perceptions are eliminated, and subtle perceptions, maybe useful perceptions, are aroused during the practice. Now, he mentioned before one attains first jhana, one was with some gross perceptions due to sensual desires, ill wills, sotta and torpor, restlessness and worry, and various doubts. So those are actually the ones cluttering the mind, and all those perceptions which cause to crowd the mind are all now eliminated. Instead of those, now subtle perception of delight and happiness, born of detachment or born of relinquishment, are available in the mind. So therefore, now it is a very healthy atmosphere available in the mind, and the perceptions available are also very subtle. And all the other gross harmful perceptions pertaining to the five sense cords are now temporarily subsided. So Buddha's statement, because of the training, some beneficial subtle perceptions are being aroused, and all harmful gross perceptions are being put aside. And then Buddha further explained that how one may come to the second jhana by eliminating vitakka vichara, applied mind and a sustained mind. So now one may has even subtle perception, and that is more stronger than in terms of the concentration, that is more stronger than the first jhana. So therefore, the perceptions are available right now in the second jhana is happiness born of concentration. Mind does not waver. Mind is fairly fixed. Mind is fairly concentrated. So as a result of that, second jhana is more with concentration and rupture, because all the hindrances are put aside. Now one reaches third jhana, what one has is the equanimity born and the happiness. So fair amount of happiness, contentment, equanimity. So those are the characteristics in the third jhana. So the little gross, rupturous perceptions are now eliminated. Instead of that, more subtle happiness, contentment are available in the third jhana. And then one reaches fourth jhana, even that happiness being eliminated, now more mature kind of equanimity is available in the fourth jhana. And so far actually we were in the material realm. Now one shifts to the immaterial realm or the arupa jhana. There also Buddha explains how one reaches subtle levels, subtle jhanic levels through the practice. And after one reaches the final, that is the nothingness, according to this sutta, so that Buddha mentioned as a sanyag, the summit of perception. And there are one interesting determination that the yogi made. So that is where he actually going through this whole practice, he understood. So whenever I am inclined towards a new kind of perceptions and trying hard and make intentional kind of pursuit, intentional kind of endeavor to achieve it, then those gross perceptions are eliminated. Now new subtle perception is aroused. Again and again, that's what has happened. After understanding that, so he had a kind of interesting determination. How about not having a new perception at all? How about eliminating all the available perceptions and not making any intentional effort? So this kind of a radical determination now the yogi is making, because he understood the disadvantages of this newly arisen perceptions and again this whole procedure. So he make a kind of a radical reflection not to make any intentions and not to make any kind of preparations or fabrications. He altogether stopped the fabrications and he don't make any intention. So as a result of that, Buddha mentioned now one may touches the cessation, the Nirodha. And then a very interesting question asked by Pottapada. So Pottapada is asking now, is it just the one summit of perception available through which that one is able to touch the cessation, or are there many summit of perceptions available? Then Buddha mentioned, I declare even one summit of perception and I declare many summits of perception. Then how? Buddha mentioned, wherever that you are, if you are able to stop altogether these making intentions and to incline towards any new kind of perceptions, if you make that determination at any given place and you are able to touch the cessation, so those bases can be considered as summit of perception. So there are many summits of perception. So if one makes that radical reflection and while being in the first jhana, so one is able to successful, he was able to touch the Nirodha, touch the cessation. So this is very much the discussion that we have gone through so far, and this is very much the essence of the sutta. And now we'll get on to the other part, now what Buddha further explains. Now after mentioning that whole thing, now Pottapada get on to ask various kinds of other questions. Now he actually is a person with self-view, following different kinds of wrong views. So as a result of that, he actually get on asking various questions related to the soul. And even before that he asked whether the perception come first or the knowledge come first. And the commentary mentioned this is in different ways. So commentary actually gives different explanation to these questions. Anyway, one explanation given is that whenever a kind of an awakening happen in one particular person, in a practitioner, whether the awakening happen first or the knowledge about the awakening happens first. Then Buddha mentioned the perception of the awakening happened first, and then the reflections, the paccavekkhana jnana, the reflection knowledges are happened next. So that is how this question being interpreted in the commentary. And this, after mentioned that, now Pottapada get on to his typical soul-oriented questions, and now he is asking Bhante, is the perception a person's self? Now, this is being somewhat criticized by various commentaries, because Buddha went through a kind of a gradual process, never mentioned about anything called soul, but Pottapada is now diverting the discussion to another direction. That is the question of soul. And now when Pottapada asks whether the perception is person's self or person's self, then Buddha asks, what do you mean by the soul? What do you postulate by a self? And then Pottapada mentioned the self that I am talking here is a gross made out of four elements and feeding off solid food. So basically that is the body that he is referring as the self here. Olarika Attapatilabha. So this is referred as Olarika Attapatilabha, so a kind of a self made with four elements and fed with the solid food. So that is the body. So he here consider the body as the self. Then Buddha mentioned there are various perceptions arouse out of even I mean out of the body. So perceptions arouse in the mind. So therefore, even though you consider body as the self, now perceptions are available in the mind. So they are available again and again. So therefore, we can say if you consider body as self, since perceptions are different, so you can't say body the body as a self. So basically the perceptions as a self, because if one's perception is the self, so one has to have full control of it. It can't arouse out of it. So perceptions can't arouse out of the self. Now when Pottapada consider body as the self, when perceptions arouse out of that domain, so that indicates or that proves Pottapada's postulation is wrong. So therefore Buddha deny that self is basically one thing, and that is the body that you are talking here, and the perception is another thing. So therefore Buddha denies the question. And then Pottapada now asks a separate question, whether the self is the mind-made self, manomaya attapatilabha. Now he is going to the mental level, and it doesn't have any defects due to various bodily sense organs. Rather, it's a completely mind-made one. Now it's a mind-made self. Pottapada is talking. Still, it is rupee. It is still visible. And now Pottapada asks this question. And even there, Buddha mentioned the same answer. So there are perceptions aroused even out of this domain, even the out of mind-made level. So therefore, you can't consider self as the mind-made self, be a kind of a mind-made self, and the perception is different. So there also, Buddha didn't agree. And again, now Pottapada asks, I assume a formless self. It's completely formless. There is no rupa, no matter at all. And is it made up of perception? And there also Buddha mentioned perception still arouse at other places. Therefore, you can't even consider formless self as the perception. Say, for example, if one is considering formless self as the perception, whenever other kinds of perceptions arouse, so if they are not in that category, so that means so this those perceptions are out of the self. So therefore, considering self as the perception in this sense also not possible. So likewise, Buddha basically did not agree telling any of these solutions as the self or as the perception. And now Pottapada further get on asking various other questions, which are very much like Buddha purposely put aside, purposely never answered. So those are very much like undeterministic questions. Abhyakata vyakarana. So basically, different people come forward and ask various questions about the soul, about the next life of a Tathagata. So likewise, these are very philosophical kind of questions, and again mostly based on the self view. And those are around 10 questions are there, and all those 10 questions now asked by Pottapada. Now he starts to ask, is the world eternal? And Buddha mentioned that I am not declaring something like that, I am not telling anything about it. Then Pottapada asks whether the world is not eternal. Then the further Buddha mentioned, I am not determined on that, I am not declaring anything like that. And then Pottapada asks whether the world is infinite or whether it is not infinite. So there also Buddha mentioned, I am not telling anything about it, I simply put aside that question. And then Pottapada came to ask about the soul, and whether the soul is the body or the body is different from the soul. There also Buddha put it aside. And after mentioning that, now he is asking about the result of the passing away of a Tathagata. So basically here we can consider Tathagata as the Buddha as well as the Tathagata as the Arahant. So Tathagata, the word Tathagata literally means the one who has gone. And basically this question applied even to the Arahant. So people are asking, so what happened after the Arahant passed away? So even at the end of the death, after the death, is the Tathagata exist? Then Buddha, they are also Buddha don't answer. So Buddha mentioned, I am not answering that. I am not determining. I am not giving a deterministic or definite answer on that. And then the Pottapada asks the opposite, whether Tathagata does not exist after death. Or then he asks whether both exist and not exist. Then he asks, neither exist nor none exist. Now all these four questions are quite popular and available in many suttas, and many ascetics come and ask either from the Buddha or ask from various other companion monks, and they basically don't go on to answer these questions, and they basically put them aside. And after Buddha put them aside without giving any definite answer, then Pottapada asked another question. And he asked, why Buddha is not answering these questions? That is also a very interesting question, by the way. So Buddha, if he has omniscient knowledge, he should answer these questions. But now Buddha is not answering. Then Pottapada asks, why are you not answering them? Then Buddha mentioned very interestingly, so those questions are not conducive to the spiritual life, and not conducive to Dhamma, and they don't arouse any kind of urgency to go out of the samsara, and again they do not lead to any disenchantment, do not lead to any dispassion, and not to the cessation or to calm down the mind towards the higher knowledge or to achieve enlightenment or to achieve Nibbana. So therefore all these questions are more confusing and based on wrong view of a self, and therefore it is get on to more and more thicket of wrong views. And more one thinks, more one become more confused and going out of the spiritual path, one become more and more confused, engrossed in various views. So therefore Buddha mentioned, I am not answering these questions. Now, Vattapada asks, what you are basically answering, or what you have properly declared. I mean, all these 10 questions, Buddha not giving definite answer, he's not declaring any definite answer. Now, Potapada asks, what you have kind of a definite answer, for what you are having definite answer, what you declare basically. So there Buddha mentioned about the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, there is cause of suffering, there is cessation, and there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. There is cessation of suffering, and there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. So basically, Four Noble Truths are the ones that Buddha mentioned that I am telling as a definite fact, which is leading to the enlightenment. So actually, that question again asked by the Potapada, why you are declaring these four truths? What is the special reason? Then Buddha mentioned, so this actually serve the purpose. Actually, when one is considering these four truths, when one's practice is more oriented towards these four truths, then basically he's in the proper track, he's in the proper path. And again, that kind of a practice is conducive to Dhamma and conducive to the enlightenment, and it is making the purpose of the holy life. And it will lead to the calmness, higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. So basically, these are the four areas that I am talking, I am explaining in with more definite terms, and therefore I am talking all these Four Noble Truths. And after mentioning that, so Pottapada is now happy with Buddha's answers, and always when Buddha says something, he was quite agreeable, and he actually prays Buddha for his answers, even though he's a wandering ascetic, having basically some wrong views still, but still he could appreciate Buddha's answers, and he basically invited Buddha to give his own views. So likewise, Gotabada was quite loyal to Buddha in that sense, agreeable to the Buddha. And now at the end of the discussion, now Potapada say, okay Bhante, now it is the time for you to continue your Pindapatha. So likewise, he basically concludes the discussion, and then Buddha rise up, and then he went out. And after Buddha left, an interesting thing happened. Now when Vattapada and Buddha was discussing all these things, there were many other followers around Vattapada, and actually they are Vattapada's students and the followers. They were not happy about this discussion, even though Vattapada was quite delighted with Buddha's answer and was praising the Buddha, none of the others. So immediately after Buddha left, so they start blaming Vattapada. So it is mentioned like they approached, sneered, and jeered at Potapada from all different sides. So they were telling, I mean, you were simply behaving like a student of when ascetic Gautama. Whenever he tell this, you always praised him. So, but he didn't answer any of the questions that you asked at the end, those 10 questions where Buddha didn't give a definite answer. So you did the wrong thing. So basically, they started criticizing Potapada. And then actually, Potapada make a very honest opinion here, honest comment here. So he mentioned, yes, it is true. Buddha didn't answer those 10 questions, but he is showing a path. He's showing a path which is taking whoever the practicing to a more sublime level, more supramundane level. So I can feel it. I can really have some understanding about it. When I have such kind of an understanding about his path, when I can really appreciate it, how I can criticize him? So therefore, this Pottapada make a very honest comment there, even though his followers, students are criticizing him for approving the Buddha. So again he mentioned, even though Buddha didn't answer those 10 questions, he still declared a very interesting path, which is leading towards more sublime states, which is leading towards enlightenment. So by knowing that, I can't criticize him. So he make a very interesting comment there. So here, but the ascetic Gautama teaches a true and real way of practice, which is consonant with Dhamma and grounded in Dhamma. And why should not a man like me express approval of such a true and real practice, so well taught by the ascetic Gautama? So this is the comment that Potapada is making. So he admit that Buddha has kind of a very good solution, even though he didn't answer those 10 questions. Now that episode is now over. Now Buddha also has left, so this discussion has finished. And now, after another 2-3 days, Potapada go to meet the Buddha. Now, in this occasion, actually, Buddha visited Potapada's place. Now, after 2-3 days, Potapada with another companion go to meet the Buddha. The other companion is one called Chitta, the son of an elephant trainer. Chitta Hatti Sariputta. So, he's a son of elephant trainer. Chitta is the name. Not the Chitta as the mind, here Chitta is the name of the person. Now, Potapada not went alone to meet the Buddha, but he accompanied this Chitta. Now, after he went to meet the Buddha, so they had a typical cordial discussion. And then Potapada remembered the discussion that he and the Buddha had 2-3 days ago. And he mentioned, so after Bhante you left, all those ascetics, all those wanderers, actually they started criticizing me because I approved you. I understood what you were talking. But they started criticizing me. So he actually revealed what has happened. Then Buddha make an interesting comment here. Potapada, all those wanderers are blind and sightless. You alone among them are sighted. So basically, only the Potapada has a kind of a vigilance, intellect, to understand what Buddha was talking. None of the others. So therefore, Buddha here praised Potapada's that skill, and he mentioned that none of the others actually understood what I was talking. So basically, Buddha again reiterated that he didn't answer those 10 questions because those are not conducive to the practice, not conducive to Dhamma, not leading towards enlightenment, towards Nibbana. So therefore, I am not answering those 10 questions. But I am declaring Four Noble Truths. If one is talking about them, if one is searching about them, if one is practicing about them, then that is leading towards the end of suffering. That is leading towards the enlightenment, towards Nibbana. So that is why I am giving a definite answer on those. So, okay. The self and then 10 undeclared questions. Now this discussion, basically, okay, I think we have covered, actually I have to go to another entirely different topic hereafter, still coming into the Potapada Sutta. Now, if we little elaborate more on to the Four Noble Truths, where Buddha mentioned more with emphasis and more with the determined answer that he is giving. So he is pointing out this is suffering, and then this is the arising of suffering, cause of suffering, and this is the ending of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and this is the path leading to the ending of suffering. So now these are the Four Noble Truths. In summary, Buddha highlights, and all his teaching is very much summarized. there is suffering. Now, there is suffering is a kind of an objective form, a kind of a statement which is more directing. It is not that I am suffering, there is your suffering or there is my suffering. Rather, his statement is idang dukkhang ariya satcham. So there is suffering. So objectively he is putting it like there is suffering. And then there is the cause of suffering. So the cause of suffering is there, that you need to look at it. There is cause of suffering. And there is cessation of suffering. And there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. Now you can see there is no self there. There is no person there. Rather, there is suffering. Now this has to be properly understood. Otherwise, it's very difficult to explain the Buddha's teaching. So everything, in essence, Buddha talks in the cause and effect relationship in terms of the dependent origination. And so there is suffering and there is a cause of suffering. So there is a cause of suffering. As a result of that, they are going to have suffering. And if you are able to practice a path leading to the cessation of suffering, so yeah, the outcome is the cessation of suffering. So therefore, cessation of suffering is something that one can achieve by practicing Buddha's teaching. So therefore, ultimate result is cessation of suffering. In other terms, happiness. So if one is practicing Four Noble Truths, so what he slowly start to experience is not the suffering, but the cessation of suffering. More and more, he should experience less and less suffering. Now, therefore, one can't say that Buddha is talking every time about the suffering. Rather, he admit there is suffering, and again admit there is a cause of suffering. But now he declares a path. If one practices that properly, which leads to the cessation of suffering. So therefore, the outcome, the final result, is not suffering. It's actually the cessation of suffering, Nibbana. So therefore, the result is very much a more positive aspect, not something negative. So some people actually criticize Buddha's teaching that he always talking suffering, but he starts with suffering, but the result of the practice is not the suffering, rather the end of suffering. So that one needs to understand. And again, there is suffering here is kind of a, even though it is simply a statement, so one needs to understand what is suffering. So that is also Buddha, very clearly mentioned. So basically, he mentioned it in many different ways. One answer, one explanation is that all five aggregates, clinging aggregates, are suffering. And another answer is all sense bases are suffering. So you can see, so whatever the condition phenomena as suffering. So when one try to look at suffering and the other truths, so there are kind of a stages that one has to go through. So each and every this what you call noble truth has three aspects. So there is a theoretical part, what we call as the pariyatti, and then there is patipada, a practice, and then the result, that is called pativeda. So it is applicable to the first noble truth, applicable to the second noble truth, applicable to the third noble truth, and applicable to the fourth noble truth. So altogether, 3 into 4, there will be 12-fold kind of answer, a full comprehensive answer Buddha is giving. So if one needs to understand Four Noble Truths, therefore one has to understand them in all these three angles to each and every noble truth. So with respect to the first noble truth, the theory part, is that there is suffering. Now, what is suffering then? So Buddha tell, okay, five aggregates are suffering, five clinging aggregates are suffering. And there are other answers Buddha given, like say birth is suffering, decaying is suffering, aging is suffering, disease is suffering, being with the dislike is suffering, separation from the like is suffering, and whatever one like, not having it is also suffering. And ultimately, in summary, all five clinging aggregates are suffering. Now, if one needs to practice, one needs to understand this suffering. So understanding is the main thing with respect to the first noble truth, Dukkham Parinyaya. So it is not that you are trying to get rid of suffering, rather you have to fully comprehend suffering. It doesn't mean that you have to go in search of different kinds of suffering and torment yourself to understand suffering. Rather, one needs to understand more precisely or more accurately the five clinging aggregates, because Buddha mentioned five clinging aggregates are the suffering. The five clinging aggregates: the material aggregate, the rupakkhanda, then the feeling aggregate, perceptions aggregate, formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate. So one has to explore these five aggregates if one needs to understand the first noble truths. So if one did a fair amount of exploration, fair amount of investigation onto these five clinging aggregates, then to some extent one can say, yes, I understood five clinging aggregates. And with respect to the second noble truth, that there is second noble truth, the cause of suffering. So that is the craving, and there are three kinds of craving: the sensual desire, then the desire to become, and desire to get rid of. Kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So with respect to tanha, craving, the activity, the patipada, what needs to implement is to abandon craving. Dukkha samudayam pahatabba. One needs to abandon the cause of suffering. And if one has done that, then one may understood the task or the result, that is, one has abandoned, already abandoned the cause of suffering. And when one reaches the third noble truth, so third noble truth is referred as a Nibbana, the cessation of suffering. And it is mentioned chago, patinissaggo, mutti, analeo. So basically the relinquishment, the abandonment of suffering, the craving, then release, freedom, dispassion. So these are the terms referred to indicate the Nibbana. And Buddha mentioned the Patipada is to realize Nibbana, that one needs to realize Nibbana, not just imagine or read about Nibbana, but one has to practically realize Nibbana. The third aspect is that one needs to, if one is realized, then one can say, yes, I understood, I realized the Nibbana. So the fourth noble truth is the path leading to realize Nibbana, path leading to the cessation of suffering. So what is the path? So that is Noble Eightfold Path. So Noble Eightfold Path, theoretical understanding is that, okay, you have three trainings: Sila Sikkha, Samadhi Sikkha, Panya Sikkha, the moralities, concentration and wisdom. So this is simply the theoretical part. The practical path, the Patipada, is that one needs to develop it. One can't just read about it, but rather one needs to live according to it. One needs to cultivate it. One need to cultivate the right view. One need to cultivate the right intention. One needs to cultivate the proper words, proper activities, a proper livelihood. And one has to develop the mindfulness. One has to develop concentration. One has to develop some wisdom. So likewise, there are cultivations, developments one needs to do. So therefore, the aspect of the fourth noble truth is that it has to be bhavetabbang. Dukkha nirodhagamini patipada bhavetabbang. One needs to cultivate it. One needs to develop it. And when one has fully developed it, then one can say, it's okay, I have done it. I have fully developed it. So likewise, interestingly, so Buddha's whole teaching is fairly oriented towards these four noble truths. So we were discussing about five aggregates. So those five aggregates coming under the First Noble Truth. We have discussed various kinds of practices, say with respect to the Pottapada Sutta, or with respect to the Sabbasava Sutta, so Anapanasati Sutta, Satipatthana Sutta. So all these are different practices where Buddha orients at these different four truths. Either they are operating at the level of the suffering, First Noble Truth, or either they are operating at the level of the Second Noble Truth, Third Noble Truth, or the Fourth Noble Truth. So all these different teachings that Buddha explained, we can actually put into these Four Noble Truths. So therefore Buddha mentioned, so I declare these Four Noble Truths. This is my core teaching. So this I am telling with definite. This I am telling more firmly, because these are leading to the end of suffering. These are leading towards the Nibbana. These are leading towards the enlightenment, to the dispassion, to say, towards the disenchantment, to go out of the samsara. So that is why I am giving more emphasis. That is why I am teaching these Four Noble Truths. But I am not talking about the 10 indeterministic questions that I am putting aside. So this answer Buddha is giving to Pottapada, and he reiterates even when Pottapada and Chitta comes to meet him. So we'll discuss further about their discussion, what Buddha was discussing with Chitta and the Pottapada when they are meeting. So with that, I like to conclude today's Sutta teaching session. Now I like to open the session for questions.
Joining us for the very first time, you may participate in the Q&A by raising your hand or sending the questions via chat. So, Bunde, while we wait for the questions, I was wondering, as we are continuing our practice, is it possible to experience moments of Nibbana as we are on the path?
Yeah, we can say yes, because Nibbana, actually Buddha, actually this question asked in many different ways from the Buddha. So Nibbana sometimes is defined as the completely ultimate kind of goal, or completely with a perfection, perfected state. So there we can say this is Tanhakkaya, Ragakkaya, Dosakkaya, Mohakkaya. So that means the complete elimination of lust, complete elimination of hatred, complete elimination of delusion. So in that sense, we can't say that I am now experiencing that full-fledged Nibbana. But on the other hand, so you can't immediately have the full-fledged Nibbana. So you can't have quick enlightenment where, say, one had thousands of, I'm just giving example, assume that you have thousands of a huge amount of lust. So in 1 second you cut everything. You have a huge amount of hatred. In 1 second you cut everything. You had complete delusion, and immediately you are out of delusion. So there is no such kind of a thing. So therefore Buddha gave a kind of a relative Nibbana in that sense. So one may achieve Nibbana gradually. So it is called Tadanga Nibbuti. So questions are asked from the Buddha. Bante Tadanga Nibbuti, Tadanga Nibbuti is said. So what is this Tadanga Nibbuti? Then Buddha explained, so it's a kind of a gradual healing that you are going through. It's a kind of a gradual purification that you are going through. So at first, suppose you were having a lot of defilements, you were burning with lust, you were burning with hatred, you were completely confused, you were completely in a deluded state. But when you are able to abandon five hindrances, comparatively you are in a Nibbana. Relatively you are in a Nibbana, relatively you are in a very good mental state. So therefore, with respect to the previous, more gross, vulnerable, say a hindered state of mind, now you are in a better position. Assume that now you are in first jhana. So that is comparatively a kind of a Nibbana, and therefore Buddha appreciate that. And then assume that you are reaching the second jhana. So even the little bit of cluttering available in the first jhana is not available in the second jhana. Therefore, comparatively, you are in a much better position while being in the second jhana. So likewise, Buddha explained that one may achieve gradual purification. Suppose now you are practicing vipassana. There also, assume that you practice, say, satipatthana, mindfulness practice, and all these things, and you are able to carefully eliminate five hindrances, maybe temporary. So you are in a better position with respect to the previous state. Now you are in Nibbana with respect to the previous state. Now you come across, okay, still I am not completely free from five hindrances. So how I can completely eliminate these five hindrances? So you are further purifying yourself. Say you are practicing Cittanupassana, you are practicing Dhammanupassana. So likewise, you are broadening your practice. Now suppose you are able to maintain the undefiled state of mind for a longer time. So comparatively, now you are in a better position than previously, and therefore you are more in Nibbana now. Now with respect to the craving, craving has somewhat eliminated now. The sensual desire has somewhat eliminated. So as you are going forward, so slowly you may understand, okay, more and more defilements are subsided, more and more they are weakened. Instead, more kind of sublime states are available. So those are more comfortable, not burning, but calming down, relaxing. So therefore, one may achieve Nibbana gradually. So to answer your question, so time to time, so whenever one experiences these kinds of temporary release, temporary freedom, that actually has a motivation towards the completed or the perfected kind of Nibbana. It is not that we can have the perfect Nibbana immediately, that we may experience kind of a temporary and comparative or relative Nibbana because of the practice. So that practice, as we are enhancing, as we are further developing, which becomes more refined level of mind, which has more kind of understanding, wisdom, and say less burning, more calm, more cool. So therefore, that cooling effect may improve as we may progress. So therefore, Jennifer, to answer your question, I mean, we can't say that we are fully in Nibbana, perfect Nibbana. Rather, we are gradually moving towards that, we can say.
Okay, yeah, thank you. But Bande, I guess when you talk about, Nibbana being free of, those hindrances and defilements, when you're in a state of jhana, it's also free of those defilements. But I would expect that, and I'd expect that actually, the perfect Nibbana feels quite different than even any states of jhana,
Yeah, that's the
right?
thing. Yeah, that's why the jhana and all the other states are to be used to achieve perfect Nibbana. So you are coming to a level which is not perfect Nibbana, but comparatively it's a better state. But now being there, you need to try to move forward towards a perfect Nibbana. Say for example, assume that you are in the first jhana. And then after emerging from first jhana, you need to consider what are the disadvantages, what are still the kind of drawbacks in this first jhana, how I can further perfect it. Then you probably understood, okay, still some wavering of mind is there, still some say different images are there, subtle perceptions are there. So if I want to make it further refined, further purified, I need to eliminate all those different kinds of imperfections. Then only I may be further developed towards the perfection. So likewise, so you need to recognize what are the burning effects in the mind, what are the deluding effects in the mind, deluding factors in the mind, causes in the mind, and those causes are to be eliminated. So in terms of the vipassana, so that is where one needs to be vigilant, continuously recognizing those deluding factors. How mind being further deluded, how mind being further cluttered, further stressed. So if we are able to develop a path which is eliminating these stresses, eliminating these delusions, and then more and more one needs to feel comfortable. One needs to feel less sorrowful, less worrying, less burning. Instead, one's mind is more purified, more calm, serene, no stress, no tension. So this is a, that's why I mean it's a kind of a gradual path. And even in the Pottapada Sutta, so Buddha talks that gradual path. Because of the practice, you are able to eliminate gross perceptions and you are able to achieve more subtle perceptions. And at a given moment, probably, say you come across that radical reflection, okay, I am not going to make any more intentions. Let me try to stop intentional activities. So then, probably, the yogi may touch the cessation. So that also still temporary because mind still has latent tendencies. Whenever they become active, so again you come out of that cessation. So therefore, one needs to recognize what are the root causes for not having Nibbana, not to realize Nibbana, to not to be in Nibbana. So those causes are to be eliminated. So when those causes are eliminated, so then one can say he has nothing to do. Basically, he is in Nibbana. So I mean we can't say he, I mean so that the mind is experiencing Nibbana then. All the causes causing burning, causing stress, causing tension are all eliminated. Now mind is naturally there.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. I'd like to invite Sweeney to ask the next question.
Thank you
Yeah.
very much for the beautiful, beautiful teaching you did. And I was thinking, because it's so subtle, the perception, so when you go to even the formless self, say the Arupa Jhana, it can't be maintained. So therefore you realize even that is suffering because it's anicca, dukkha, therefore there's no atta. Now my question here is if I'm then you go on to training of the mind to detach, therefore because you realize nibbida viraga nirodha, and now the why I'm training my mind is because it's conducive to the purpose of nibbana. So is it all right to think I'm training my mind for the purpose of nibbana? Or is that also a tanha, a type of tanha, because you're a tanha for nibbana? But then I'm thinking, then you realize then this isn't a right, that's a Buddha's questions, Pottapada's questions. And the Buddha's answers, it just shows when there is cause and effect, it's a arising and passing away phenomena of all psychophysical, psychophysical phenomena. Then when you realize it's a cause and effect, therefore get rid of the cause, then there's no effect either. So therefore, so is it all right to say I'm training my mind because of nibbana, or is that also green?
No, actually, so this question actually asked or actually answered by Venerable Ananda. So he mentioned tanhang nibbaya tanha pahatabbu. So you may use tanha, craving, a desire, in order to eliminate craving or to abandon craving. And you sometimes even use conceit in order to abandon conceit. So it appear this kind of a answer appear like kind of contradicting, but still practical point of view, it is true. Because basically whenever we start our practice, so we have to have some kind of a motivation. Say like, say, I want to attain Nibbana, I want to become a Sotapanna, I want to practice mindfulness. So likewise, kind of a driving force is within us, so that requires some kind of a personal involvement. But later, as we are growing in the practice, so our understanding about the Nibbana may change. So at the beginning, we have a kind of an understanding about the Nibbana. But while we are in the practice, to some extent, we have another idea of Nibbana. And as we move further, again, we have a different kind of a view about the Nibbana. So likewise, the understanding about Nibbana is varying. So at the beginning, we has a lot of personality view, we had a lot of defilements, a lot of hindrances. With that kind of a mentality, we are having an idea about Nibbana. And to achieve that Nibbana, I am trying now. Assume that you are now practicing mindfulness and all sorts of things. And that actually purify your mind to some extent. Arouse some wisdom to some extent. With that purified mind, with that wise mind, now you have a different type of a Nibbana. So that is your goal now. Suppose you are continuing further. Now your mind is further purified. And further wisdom is available. Further concentration is available. Now you are experiencing these things. I mean, these are not simply you are passing an exam and getting onto another exam. I mean, rather, you are experiencing more purification within the mind. You are experiencing more kind of a clarity available in your mind. More wisdom available in your mind. With that clarity, with that wisdom, with that kind of a mindfulness, develop mindfulness. Now you have a better understanding about the Nibbana. So likewise, so the idea about Nibbana we had is continuously evolving as we continue our path. Now, at the beginning, you had a strong self. I want to achieve Sotapanna. I want to become a Sotapanna. But in the middle, sometimes while being in the practice, you all of a sudden realize, where is I? What should I consider as I? Is the body I? Is the perceptions I? Is the, say, mental formations I? So likewise, you yourself have a kind of a radical reflection, where is I? So who is going to realize Nibbana now? So those kinds of radical realizations may happen in between. So therefore, with that kind of an understanding, now you have a better understanding about the Nibbana, and you, rather than now trying to achieve Nibbana, you may start to be in Nibbana. Not as a person, but to dwell in Nibbana. So likewise, I mean, there are some radical changes happen in our practice as we move forward. So therefore, Venerable Ananda says, so first up, at the beginning, probably you may have a desire to achieve Nibbana, to realize Nibbana, but slowly, even that desire is abandoned. You previously had a kind of a desire or tanha, craving towards Nibbana. Even as you move forward, even that craving is abandoned. Previously, you had a kind of a conceit that I also attain Nibbana because my friend has tried hard. So, I mean, there are such incidents. Say, for example, in the sutta it is mentioned, say one monk hears, okay, his friend monk, he has become an arahant. Now, this particular monk reflect, so my friend has achieved Nibbana, so then why can't I achieve Nibbana? Why I can't become an arahant? So, this is a conceit-based idea. But that conceit-based idea actually motivates him to practice. But as he moves forward, he may realize that the conceit itself has to be abandoned. So therefore, it's a very interesting path in a way. I mean, even though it appears like contradicting, but practically, so you are, as you move forward, that very craving is abandoned, very conceit is abandoned, and the very self-view is abandoned. So it's an interesting path, actually. That's what I like to say on that.
Swini, just wanted to confirm, do you have any other follow-up questions?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Bante. So now I realize Nibbana is not a place to go to.
Uh-huh.
It is nirvata, elimination. Just elimination of raga, dosa, moha.
Yeah.
Therefore, there's no need to think I am training for this purpose, because I think when one is practicing and training, naturally the raga dosa moha will fade away.
And yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Bhante, may I ask a follow-up question to what you've just explained? So as you progress, so originally you may have been driven by your craving, and now even the craving itself is starting to lessen.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that keeps you going on the path? Is it just this notion that this is the, well, no, is it just more so of that's just your way of being, that, you know, more and more you are just naturally without or have lessened the defilement,
mm-hmm.
and so naturally you just progress forward?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a kind of a momentum. So it's very much like, as far as I understood now, actually the natural state of mind is very much Nibbana, but we were away from Nibbana because of our delusion, because of our defilements. But more and more we practice, so kind of an inclination is available for the purification. That's why Buddha mentioned. So assume that Buddha gave you a very beautiful simile sometimes. Suppose there is a log, kind of a, say, trunk of a tree being fallen to a river. Now, if that trunk of a tree is not blocked while traveling towards the ocean, if it is not blocked in the bank of a river and not being sighted by people and collected it, and not being sunk inside, or not being eaten by something and then completely rotten, completely deteriorated. If all these different accidents are not happened, all these problems have not happened, then where is it leading to? Can you answer, Jennifer?
It's just naturally down whichever way the river is flowing.
Exactly. So that is, it is leading towards the ocean. So therefore Buddha mentioned, so the mind is also very much like that. So if these defilements are not hindering the mind, if slowly the defilements are eliminated, so if all these hindrances are eliminated, if you are not blocked by all this gain, fame and all these other things either, the mind may naturally move towards Nibbana. So actually, I mean, put it in the term of a practitioner. So if a practitioner is leading, so if he is not being caught with gain and fame, if he is not with other different activities, so likewise he may continue the practice, ultimately leading towards Nibbana. So certain terms, like in Pali it is mentioned as Nibbana Ninnang, Nibbana Ponang, Nibbana Pabharam. It's very much like a tree, I mean, inclined towards the river. So in case that tree is fallen, it is falling onto the river. So likewise, I mean, it is moving towards Nibbana, but the problem is we purposely avoid it. It's very much like because of our delusion.
Uh-huh.
So we are circulating because of our delusion. So if one is able to remove those hindering reasons or hindering causes, so the natural tendency has to be in the Nibbana.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that requires quite a bit of faith in the practice.
Definitely.
Faith,
I mean, you can't say that without a practice that your mind may naturally go towards Nibbana. I mean, one, you have to sort of prepare that necessary momentum at the beginning, and you have to put the proper orientation, and that is where Buddha mentioned that Sotapanna is referred as Sot. I mean, you come to the Noble Eightfold Path. One may recognize Noble Eightfold Path as one's practice. So now only Buddha even say that you are a trainee. You are doing a proper training. So far you were going astray. You are going this side, you are going that side, you are going in this direction, that direction. You didn't have a proper orientation even. But when one realizes the Noble Eightfold Path, okay, recognize the Noble Eightfold Path, okay, this is the path to lead. This is the thing to do. So that is very much like you are quite definite about it. It is not through a book, rather through your own practice you will become more confident. Okay, this is what to do. Now you are very well aware, okay, this is the path to develop. Then very much like, okay, you can simply maintain the path. You are definite, okay, this is the thing to do. It's a matter of maintaining. Let me continue the practice. Let me maintain necessary amount of morality, concentration, wisdom. So the mind may slowly moving towards the Nibbana.
Thank you, Bhante. I have a written question here that says, Dear Bhante, could you please explain the relationship or difference between sunyata, single concentration, and jhanas? Thank you.
Yeah, so actually jhana always has an object. So basically first jhana, if you are achieving through metta, say your mind is more focused on a particular object, particular person, and with that person you have a mental image and to which the mind get absorbed. Suppose you are achieving first jhana using anapanasati, so there is a concentration sign. Again and again you are applying your mind to that concentration sign, and ultimately your mind get absorbed to that concentration sign. So likewise, there are always a kind of a sign available, a kind of a concept available in the Samatha Jhana, and even at the level of Arupa Jhana, there is a concept, there is a perception available to which your mind is conditioned. But on the other hand, when one reaches the Sunyata, there one may reaches through practice, and say you are practicing Vipassana and you understand the impermanent nature, the suffering, unsatisfactory nature, and the non-self nature. So those are very much lead into the dispassion, very much lead into the disenchantment, relinquishment. Assume that you strongly realize there is no person here, there is no being here, there is no soul here, there is no essence here. So as a result of that, mind may eliminate everything, relinquish everything, and become free. So that we can say as the emptiness, sunyata. So there are mind does not associate anything at all. Mind is completely unestablished, unassociative, and free from any object. It's basically objectless. So sunyata, therefore, is objectless. There is no object at all. It is quite different from the Samatha Jhana, where Samatha Jhana still associate a conceptual object and a certain kind of a perception, and maintenance of the jhana is there with the constructions, formations. So likewise it's different from the Vipassana jhana or Vipassana emptiness.
Thank you, Sanjay. The next question to invite Chita Devi.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. My question is, of course, I mean, maybe you have explained a bit of it in the process, but what I was trying to say, Bhante, was that Puttapada was considered, he was a respected ascetic, and even he found it difficult to understand this self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he was obviously someone who would have been going to jhanas and things like that. I'm assuming, because he had many followers. So, though we can see parts of this non-self in meditation, when you meditate and we lose these boundaries of this body, in our real life, we have to we have to make adhisthana. So there is some sort of person or whoever, mm-hmm. to be able to refrain from you know, have correct speech, when we go out, you know, to have this determination not to gossip, all this. So there is a person of care for whatever. So because there is, if you say there is cause and effect, then we are making an effort, a deliberate effort to do the correct thing, sila samadhi
panya. Correct,
to develop those. So
you
can, though in meditation you can experience, I mean, real life, sometimes it's one sort of questions itself. So my question is, could you give us some very practical things in daily life for us to apply to really wear down this self?
Yeah. Now, say for example, as you quite correctly mentioned, so at the Sila Sikha, at the Samadhi Sikha, so there is a quite amount of self-view. So I have to become a good person. I have to abandon killing. I have to abandon stealing. I have to abandon sexual misconduct. I have to maintain proper conduct. So likewise, there is always a view of person. I have to become a good person. So this is necessary. So therefore, in the morality aspect, so there should be that motivation coming. You can't simply say, okay, there is no person, there is no self, so then I don't need to, I mean, why should I do anything wrong if there is no person? So one can argue. So therefore, so these teachings, these high teachings should not entertain at the morality level, should not entertain at the samadhi level either. Say, assume that you are achieving the first jhana, second jhana. So all these things require a fair amount of motivation, energy, and therefore I, personality view, may be driving it. But when you are moving forward, say vipassana, suppose now you are practicing dhatu manasikara, for example. So now dhatu manasikara is based on the body, so various different element characteristics now you are experiencing: hardness, softness, movements, vibrations, heat, cold, etc. So you are now continuing that for a long time, assume. And as a result of the practice, now your mindfulness is improving, clear comprehension further improving, and there are insights probably can happen. So while you are closely examining these element characteristics, so all of a sudden you probably realize, okay, this boundary of the body has gone. The compactness of the body has gone. Instead everything appear like bubbles, everything appear like waves, so everything appear like a flux. So that compactness view completely gone. So previously you had a strong view, okay, this body is mine, this body belongs to me, I am the body. But now you may have a question, so where is I now? The whole body has very much like scattered. Very much like, say, broken into pieces. So where can I fix I, myself? So probably, I mean, on the other thing, interesting thing, is as you continue this observation, eye making and mind making is temporarily stopped.
Yes.
You are not making an eye. Rather, you do the investigation. Why is investigation is continuing? You experience impermanence, you experience unsatisfactoriness, and you have some understanding about non-self, and these insights are growing. You forget about making a self. You forget about making an I. Now suppose you are, for a long time, you couldn't make an I. Suppose for 1 hour, 2 hours, so likewise, suppose you couldn't make an I, but instead you are developing wisdom. So that wisdom may question, where is I? So that indicates, actually, it is not an existing I. Rather, we are having a prepared I, mind-made I. So this preparation is temporarily halted, temporarily stopped, because we are developing another aspect. We were investigating. So while we were investigating, we couldn't make an I. Rather, we are closely examining these different phenomena. So at a given moment, you probably understand these insights. Where is I? Where is the core? And similarly, say, suppose you are observing feelings. The same thing happened there. So which feeling I consider as I? Perceptions, formations, all these things will never happen. Assume that you are experiencing complete absence of thoughts, no thought at all for a say 30 minutes. So during that time, so after you emerge from that, so you probably have a radical reflection, where was I? So the feeling of I has completely depleted even, completely absent during that period, and even when you come out of that experience, the notion of I has completely depleted. So there you may understand, yes, it is, I mean, there is no I mean, this is a kind of a cause and effect relationship. So let me continue the path, no need to arouse the feeling of I, and instead of maintaining I, now you are trying to catch the glimpses of I time to time arising. Because of the delusion, time to time I make a person. My personality view being strengthened because of the delusion. It is also not happen every time now. Time to time it is happening. Now you are catching those places. So now your practice is more kind of oriented completely different. Previously it was one way, and now it is in a different orientation. Instead of frequently making an I, now you seldom makes I. Now you can even notice this I making and mind making, and kind of a comparison happen between you and another person. So these comparisons become more and more evident to a person because his mind is very clear. So I making, mind making happen rarely, time to time, and those instances appear like burden, and the person become fully sort of feeling it as a burden, as a kind of a suffering. Whenever I is present, whenever I making is present, you feel burden, you feel unsatisfied, you feel frustrated. You may feel the suffering that you have when the I is present. But when I is not present, you are quite all right. I mean, everything happens smoothly. There is no suffering. Complete serene kind of mentality is available. So you start to appreciate that rather than trying to promote an I, rather than trying to maintain an I, or rather than trying to prove an I. So you can see, because of the practice, your whole way of life has now differently oriented.
Yes, Bhante, that is right. But I think more and more to really lose the I completely, one has to move away from a lot of the worldly activities. Because otherwise, you have to, even when you go to work, you have to have an I, because you know, you have to deal with people.
I can answer like this. So Buddha mentioned that even arahants are referring themselves as I, but knowingly that I am using it for the sake of communication.
Yes.
Therefore, I mean, when your wisdom is growing, so you can make use. Now suppose you want to go to a wedding. Now you are not wearing the normal frocks that you are wearing at your home, no?
See,
so you are wearing some expensive, beautiful clothes, and then you go to the, wedding, and you participate there. And after coming back home, you keep it aside.
Yeah.
So you need to wear a cloth appropriately. So similarly, why can't you make use of the personality when it is necessary? Suppose you have to go to the job and you have to administer a group of people, and you have to show that you are the administrator. So at that time you need to have some personality, otherwise you will be failure.
Exactly.
So you are making use of it knowingly, by the way. I am using it for the purpose. It is not that I have a person here, rather I am playing the role here. I am playing the role of an administrator here. That's it.
Yes. But now that we have to make determinations, and we have to have energy, and we have to, you know, all the time to keep guard. So then also you, and there is a kind of a person, because, you know, you have to prevent mental proliferation or reading stories. Sometimes, you know, somebody says something, but there is a lot of media coming into that. All the time we have to be like watchdogs. So again, you have to create some. You can't say there's nothing there and there is a cause and effect. Then people will just sit down and say, this is the cause and effect, and do what they want. That's
yeah.
What you can't do.
Correct, correct.
But
yes, yes.
There is some. So that is the thing that the Buddha Pada was actually trying to get some proper answer.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what he was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always, even when you're doing the best things, the good intentions, there is some kind of a person overseeing this whole thing.
Yeah, actually.
You know
that,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
They are always like watchdog.
Correct, correct. Yeah.
What are we saying? What are we thinking?
Mm.
What are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yeah, true.
That's what I'm trying to put to you.
Yeah, basically the interesting point is, even that overseeing watchdog become non-personal.
Mm.
At the beginning it appear like I am watching myself.
Mm-hmm.
But later it's very much like it's an ongoing observing process.
Mm.
That is the natural awareness. But there is no person on into it. So kind of, that's why I very interestingly Buddha put them in words. In the Chetana Karaniya Sutta, Buddha mentioned, Dhammava Dhamme Abhisandeti, Dhammava Dhamme Paripureti, Apara Parang Dhamanayati. So the Dhammas, so these beautiful Dhammas get connected with the Dhammas. They are fulfilling the task, that they are making the completion of the task from this side to the other side. So even though at the beginning we feel like I am meditating, I am practicing, I am doing this and that, all these things. So Buddha mentioned, slowly as the momentum builds up, so now the dhammas start to work out. So the natural laws start to take hand. So ultimately these natural laws are the ones bringing the completion, taking from this end to the other end, from this side to the other side, from this shore to the offshore, the other shore. It's not I am doing it. I don't need to have. So Buddha even highlight that you don't need to even make an intention. Say for example, if you have a proper concentration and mindfulness, and if you are continuously observing various phenomena, and then Buddha mentioned, you don't need to even have an intention, may I have the wisdom of seeing things as they truly are. You don't need to have even an intention. Because Buddha mentioned, it is a law, it's a natural law. If one is having mindfulness and concentration, and if he is doing this continuous observation, investigation, it is natural to have the insight. It is natural to have the insight. It's a natural law to have the insight that things as they truly are. So his understanding is a natural outcome. You don't need to have a kind of a person involved telling, may I have this wisdom, great wisdom. May I have this great wisdom. So there is no even a wish for that. So if one is, it's a matter of continuing the practice. So as a result of the practice, you may get the result. It's a natural effect. Dhammava dhamme abhisandeti, dhammava dhamme paripureti, apara aparang gamanaya. So these dhammas come and join with the dhammas, and they fulfill the dhammas in order to cross from this shore to the other shore.
Yes.
So those are quite interesting.
Right.
Quite interesting, yeah.
Yeah, because it's a lot of contemplation going into this as well. Because we sit on the meditation cushion or do the walking meditation, I mean a very limited part of the day, and we have the rest of what we're doing, though of course we're studying and we're doing what we can, the Dhamma, but you know, of course, when you go to a retreat situation, you find that things flow very easily and everything is very beautiful, but then we cannot create that all the time because mm-hmm. we are living on this world.
Mm-hmm.
We are not in monasteries, we are not in monasteries, and no. we are cut out from the world.
No, actually, monasteries are also not the perfect. I mean, you can't expect monasteries to be perfect. But anyway, anyway, I mean, at the beginning, we need to practice a lot. That is, that I agree, because there are a lot of hindrances, a lot of negative aspects are available in the mind, and you need to put a lot of effort. You need, a lot of dedication is required. But when the momentum builds up, then slowly... So you may understand, okay, now I don't need to put this much of time. It's a matter of now even make use of the day-to-day mundane activities as the raw material to my own practice.
Yeah, that's what we do one day.
Yeah.
We are all the time doing it, but of course we also have to create a self at those instances to be able to, not actually forcefully doing it, but it comes because you have to get a job or work done, no?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. So it's of course one has to look at it from a different point angle, of course,
yes.
But I think it doesn't just flow just like that,
mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
because
definitely.
We are not in a retreat situation all the time.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I just put it to you because I thought Puttaparthi's question was very relevant from a man of an ascetic who had a lot of practice.
Yes, definitely. He's already an enunciant and he has explored many paths and he has participated in discussions and, he's more a spiritual person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he also highly respected the Buddha.
Exactly.
So,
So he's a wise person. He's a wise person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's a very, and again, he, I mean, with the rest of the story, you may understand, he's a very good person because now when he next time go to meet the Buddha, without going alone, actually he go with this Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer. Ultimately, this Chitta become a monk under the Buddha.
I know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, you're welcome.
Sanjay, do we have time for two more questions?
Actually, I can manage, but I don't know how many of you have to, wait without any sleep.
I think it's fine, we can keep going.
Okay.
And then those that drop off.
Okay.
So, the next question is a written question. It says, we feel very sad about our motherland, Sri Lanka. How can one keep a balance as a practitioner?
Yeah, actually, I agree with you. So if we think more, then we also become more confused and a little worried, depressed. And so basically, we all go through these kinds of situations. Say, for example, it's not Sri Lanka alone. Say nowadays, Ukraine is going through a lot of suffering, and sometimes Russia going through a lot of suffering, and sometimes even though we call today that certain countries are all doing well, that one or other time, that all of them have gone through enough suffering. Now, say for example in USA, so they have gone through the America Revolution and all these things. In China, so in the Mao Zedong's times, students were killed in the Tiananmen Square. So, the huge suffering was going through. And even in Sri Lanka in 1989, we went through a lot of suffering. So, likewise, this is the sensual world. You can't have perfection in this sensual world. So, that is what, as practitioners, we need to understand. I mean, we have to try our best, but we can't get the perfection in this sensual world. So, this is based on various impermanent conditions, and everything is kind of quite vulnerable, and whatever the solution we have is quite temporary, and time to time these kinds of different revolutions happen, different rebels happen, destructions happen, wars happen. So this is how our whole human history is made up with. different revolutions, different rebels, and different kinds of destruction, wars, battles. So now actually we are in a very vulnerable world. So this is the sensual world that we call. So we need to understand that. So it's an imperfect world. So trying to finding the perfection in an imperfect world. And again, we are giving more emphasis to the conventions. I mean, we are always trying to put boundaries to the land, which the land is inanimate, and we are trying to put a lot of boundaries, and we are putting names. Okay, I am a Sri Lankan, I am a Sinhalese, I am a Tamil, I am a European, I am a US, I am Chinese, blah, blah, blah. And we identify that with that, and we consider my state is much better than your state, I am superior than you. So all these things, very much like we are putting unnecessary emphasis onto the conventions, and we consider conventions as the truth, and we fail to see the reality, where the conventions are merely for easy communication, for the betterments of the society that we are using. But ultimately, we lose that purpose, but we kill each other because of these names, because of these boundaries, labels. People are killing each other because of these labels. Those labels are made by another group of people sometimes ago. I mean, in a way, it's complete human ignorance that we are facing. There are no solutions, basically, in that sense, because till we purify ourselves, till we are able to penetrate our own ignorance, we can't have a proper solution. Let's wish the best to the country. We can move forward, Jennifer.
My name is Sam. Thank you for explaining this beautiful sutta. And my question relates to Puttapada Sutta and a sutta that we explained a few weeks back. And ultimately, when Puttapada asked Buddha, what do you declare? Buddha explained basically in simple terms, Four Noble Truths. So my mind went way back, like 2 weeks ago, when you explained the Madhupindika Sutta. There, a similar question was asked from Buddha by the Sakyan Dandapani, who asked Buddha, "What do you teach?" I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just paraphrasing.
Correct.
And Buddha did not directly give an answer, like, "I teach Four Noble Truths."
Mm-hmm.
Buddha said, "I teach, if someone teaches to have conflict with others, I don't teach that." Likewise,
correct.
He said 4 or 5 different things, I don't remember. And then Buddha and Dandapani walked away, and then Buddha explained that to the monks, his interaction with the Sakyan, and the monks didn't understand it either. So the monks went to a Venerable Mahakachayana, who explained how papanchas arise from different forms of vijnanas. That's also a very beautiful sutta. So my question, Bhante, is there a hidden reason why Buddha did not directly tell Dandapani that the essence of what he teaches is Four Noble Truths?
Yeah, maybe, I mean, because Dandapani asked the question, what is the kind of argument you have, or what's the kind of the the term, it's not the teaching that he was referring, kind of vada, what's the kind of vada you have. So basically he might have, because in those times, actually different people have their own different opinions, and they are arguing each other to highlight their opinion and finding out what are the positive aspects of their opinion and trying to look down the other's opinion. So So therefore, different such ascetic groups are available. So their main purpose is to come get together and argue. And I am telling this, I am telling that. You are telling wrong. And my one is good. Your one is wrong. My one only is the truth, and your one completely wrong. So likewise, they used to argue. So this kind of a culture was there, and Dandapani is coming from that kind of a mentality, and he is asking, so what is your opinion? So what is your argument? Then Buddha mentioned the complete opposite. So my argument is not to argue with anyone.
Right.
So
he was looking for a conflict with the Buddha, I guess.
Maybe. So he was asking a same kind of an answer from Buddha as well. Like the other ascetic groups, I mean, they have different kinds of arguments, which are sometimes contradicting. So they have enough reasons to argue. But he was asking some similar argument from Buddha, but Buddha mentioned, my argument is not to argue with anyone. So that kind of a teaching that I am teaching. So then, even as you mentioned, even when Buddha mentioned it to the monks, they even did not recognize it, realize it, and then they went to Venerable Kachayana. So he get the kind of a very interesting solution, or rather explanation. So ultimately, so the essence is, through thinking all these arguments have born. So mental proliferation is too much thinking, obsessive thinking, and through thinking we get more confused, and we think, okay, my argument, my way of thinking, my understanding is the best, that's the truth, everyone else is wrong. So then through thinking we are very much like conditioned, our minds are conditioned. But the Buddha's teaching help us to have a kind of a relaxed state of mind, less thinking, and to sort of unweave the kind of thinking, to disentangle the mind, to very much like seeing one after the other how this thinking process happens. So it's a kind of a de-learning process through which actually we are able to understand the whole mechanism in the mind. So rather than being conditioned by the defiled thinking. So therefore it's very interesting in that sense. I mean, rather than finding out a solution through thinking, and you are finding out what are the drawbacks in thinking.
It's interesting because Buddha didn't spend a lot of time with
Dandapani. Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Pandit.
Okay.
Very interesting, both.
Yes. Okay, I think we have spent a fair amount of time today. So I think, Jennifer, this time has come for us to wind up the session. So today, actually, we have spent almost 2 hours discussing Dhamma. And with that, we were able to accumulate some merits, and we'll share these merits with all the celestial beings, all the past relatives, and whoever in need of merits. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Yattavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Yattavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Yattavata ca amhehi sambatam punya sampadam sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhiya. Akasattha ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkhantu sasanam. Akasattha ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkhantu desanam. Akasattha ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkhantu mamparam. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Idam vo nyati nam hotu sukita huntu nyatayo. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo satang samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. විමිනා පුඤ්ඤකම්මේන මාමේ බාල සමාගමෝ සතං සමාගමෝ හෝතු යාව නිබ්බාන පත්තිය සාදු සාදු සාදු. I have a small reminder that we have the Saturday clarity of mind discussion. So the link is given in the chat. If anyone is interested, please you can attend to that. The meeting ID and passcode is given in the chat. Thank you very much for participation.